Welcome to Communities of San Diego. This is Radioactive Radio, and I'm Queer J. Brad, here in the studio with two members of Cop Watch, Janice Jordan and Mary Lou. And today we're going to be talking about Cop Watch and Jake Faust and the San Diego Police Department during the early morning hours of April 4th, San Diego musician, artist, writer, and actor Jacob Faust was shot and killed by the SDPD in what they said was a routine traffic stop. The SDPD's version of events, which has been trumpeted and amplified by the corporate media, doesn't add up, and Jake's family and friends are pursuing truth and justice. The shooting is one of a long line of shootings and brutality by a police department that thinks it can get away with just about anything, and usually does. So today we'll be examining police brutality in San Diego and the resistance to it. And I want to welcome our two guests to the studio, Janice and Mary Lou. Thanks for coming in and sharing your knowledge with us. So I wonder if you could begin by talking a little bit about what Cop Watch is and a little bit about its background.
Cop Watch is actually a national movement. I want to give some history real quickly about the movement here in San Diego. We were originally the Committee Against Police Brutality. We came out of the Demetrius DeBose shooting in July of 1999. If those of you who remember, he was an NFL football player who was shot 12 times. Is that right, Mary Lou? 11 of those in his back. He was unarmed at the time, and there was a huge movement, a true grassroots movement that came out of not only the African-American community, but activist community, college communities. It was just amazing. So, and then unfortunately, there was a series of killings following Demetrius DeBose. There was Federico Adame III, who was beaten and pepper sprayed to death by the sheriffs. There was Sansore Holloway, who was shot point blank right through the heart. She was 5 months pregnant and handcuffed at the time. And we realized that we needed to have something solid and something that wasn't, you know, just going to go away after a demonstration. So the Committee Against Police Brutality was born, also known as CAP. After a few years, support kind of dwindled. You know, people always get real excited when there's a crisis. Folks come together. We realized that it was... We already knew that there was a national epidemic, but we needed to work with our sisters and brothers who are working around the country on this issue. So we came together and we decided to call ourselves the Saigon Pen Chapter of Cop Watch of San Diego. Saigon Pen... In 1985, defended himself against police officers when he was pulled over. Unfortunately, an officer was killed. Saigon Pen was found not guilty in a court of law, and he died in July of 2002, surrounding mysterious circumstances, if you will. So in honor of him, we decided to name our chapter Saigon, after Saigon Pen. We consider him a community warrior. So, we've been working with the Faust family. We've been other cases we've been working on is the Billy Venable case, the young brother who was pulled over in Encanto in October of 2003, who was shot right at the base of the head. It was almost like they had brought in an executioner. There were two officers on the scene. One was called in, shot him right at the back of the head while he was on the ground, and the police officer who killed him left the scene. That case is currently in court. We've also worked with Abina Webb, whose son was shot in the back of the head by a rubber bullet. And if you've ever seen those are big projectile. Any projectile shot at a certain speed can kill. Mm-hmm. But as a result of him being shot in the back of the head, he lost his sight and some of his hearing. And he was sent to prison as a parolee, an absconding parolee, and unfortunately was sent into the general population. And I haven't heard from the Webb family since then. We've also worked with the McCoy case in City Heights, where Patricia McCoy was arrested for asking a police officer what his badge number was and who his supervisor was. Patricia McCoy ended up being found not guilty in a court of law. We've also other cases that we've worked on was supporting the Adames, the young man who was pepper sprayed and beaten to death. And unfortunately, right now, I just I can't believe the strength of the Faust, especially Lynn, and her perseverance in this. It's amazing for me to see the mothers of these young people that are killed that just come forward and continue to fight and fight and fight and fight for this. One of the things that we've learned in Cop Watch is that you need to file a complaint for any and every single thing that you think an officer has violated for. Treating you with disrespect, calling you a name. Even if you aren't a part of the harassment, if you are a witness, you can file a complaint. You don't have to have people's names. You can have license plate numbers. You can have the number of the police car. But what we have learned through lawyers that support Cop Watch is that to leave a paper trail is the most important thing right now. A year and a half ago, when I believe it was 60 Minutes or 2020, one of those nighttime news magazines, stated they were talking about Detroit's police harassment of young people and people of color. And very quickly, they interviewed a spokesperson for the San Diego Police Department. And that spokesperson said, oh, we don't have any problems in San Diego. There were only two complaints filed last year. Now, what the Faust family learns, and people like Sister Iman, Billy Venable's mother, you have to file a complaint. Just that simple piece of paper. Usually you make a copy for the police officers involved, the police chief, but that has to go into the file, because once you get into court, the first thing the judge is going to ask, did you file a complaint? And in the case of Lynn, in the case of Sister Iman, we also file claims against the city. Unfortunately, how much was the person's life lost worth? And it has to come down to that. And that's all the beginning paperwork. We always send copies to the state attorney general's office. And now, most recently, I've learned that we should probably start filing copies with the district attorney's office. Send it to Human Rights Watch Group, ACLU, various organizations to let the San Diego Police Department or Sheriff's Department know that outside eyes are watching them. Did you want to add anything, Mary Lou? I'm just sitting here blah-blahing.
Doing great.
Okay, cool. Well, I have a bunch of questions.
Yes.
Kind of stimulated by that. And I'll maybe just... well, maybe I'll ask one or begin to ask one, and maybe we can go to some... we're also going to have some portions of an interview I did with Lynn Faust and Jake's good and longtime friend, Krista, who's been helping the family.
She's amazing.
Yeah, both of them are incredible. And so we'll be playing some clips from that. But one thing that, you know, you talk about filing complaints, and there's a, I think amongst many people, there's a feeling within San Diego that that doesn't do any good.
No, it doesn't. No, we're not living in the clouds. Yeah. The complaint will be looked at like you are absolutely mad. Mm-hmm. The police officers are doing their job. Why would they want to hurt anybody? But talking to lawyers, this is the most important thing, because what happens is it becomes a part of the Department of Justice statistics. And as a result, the FBI could come in and start investigating, just like they started investigating the city council. They started investigating the San Diego police officers that were involved in the undercover market, the underground market of selling appliances. And mm-hmm. Do you remember that a few yeah. years ago? So it is very important to do that. Oh, we know that, first of all, the complaint is going to be thrown out. The claim is going to be thrown out. But if you are going to go to court, those two simple pieces of paper, which take about 10 minutes to fill out, mm-hmm. need to be done, because that's what the judge is going to ask you first and foremost. Well, did you file a complaint? Well, yeah, we know. We also know that Jacob Faust's murder is going to go unchecked. It's going to be justifiable, as it has been the past 33 years. Not one San Diego Police Department official has been found guilty of committing a crime, of killing an individual while on duty.
Or even indicted.
Indicted once. Once. And he was found innocent in 7 seconds, 13 seconds. And it was an African-American officer. So we know that the complaints are no good, but you've got to leave the paper trail. And it does tie them up. The other thing, get this, Brad. If it wasn't so important, officers will try and talk you out of the complaint. Mm-hmm. And I've had a couple of friends that actually pulled their complaint because they were intimidated. So these statistics are very important. It's not just the demonstrations are great, the phone calling, the letter writing, the emailing, all of that is important too. But this is where it's kind of behind the scenes, you know, helping lawyers with the cases that can go on for years, like in the case of Sansaray Holloway. We're in our fifth year now of her shooting death. Still, you know, getting lawyers, still collecting information, still going after witnesses. I mean, it's a long haul. And the complaint process is just the first step. So if it wasn't that important, they wouldn't try and talk you out of it.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good indication. Okay. So I'm going to suggest then that we go right to this. This will be about 7 or 8 minutes of Lynn Faust and Jake's longtime friend Krista talking about who Jake was as a person.
Well, Jacob was 25 in February of this year. Jake was amazing. He was sweet and tender-hearted and extremely bright and very loving. He was just a wonderful son. He was a wonderful brother. He was a wonderful uncle. He loved his family very much and loved his friends very much. And Jake didn't really know any strangers. If you met him once, you'd remember him. I know it sounds biased coming from his mother, but he really was just this incredible ball of energy and brightness and love, and he always had his eye on tomorrow. You know, he always had something planned, especially with his music. He was so happy when he got this latest job because the hours were perfect for him working with the band. You know, it was 2 to 10, and it was his first full-time job with benefits in quite a while. And he was very excited about that. He was making $10 an hour, more than he had ever made. And music was his passion, you know. To listen to it, to dance to it, to play it, to write it. That was what he lived for, that and just communicating his belief of hope to people that didn't have any. He was a man of faith. Jake was a Christian. He lived what he believed. He did. He was the kind of guy that would give you his last dollar if you needed it. That was who Jake was. That pretty much sums it up. I mean, that's just a small part of it, because I can't... I would have to think long and hard to put everything that's in my heart into words as far as who I knew him to be. And like I told the gals that I talked to the other night, the loss that we have isn't just the loss as parents, you know, but Jake was... our friend. I mean, we hung out together, you know, we go to movies together and just laugh and go grab some coffee or, you know, and of course the older he got, the less time we had to do that because he was so busy and he knew so many people. And he started dancing again a few months ago, and that was something he was very excited about, that he was getting back into the dance, because his girlfriend that he had had for several years was not a dancer and did not want to learn to dance. And it was a huge part of, you know, just one of his passions. So he was really excited about that. And he was a man of many passions. And one of the best, if not the best, on the streets of San Diego.
So,
You mentioned his band.
Mm-hmm.
What was the name of the band? And
the Carney Barkers.
And what kind of music did they play?
Well, let me tell you about the first show I went to.
Okay, Chris. Okay.
I hadn't heard from Jake in a while, and but it was not unusual. He's all over the place. He had a lot going on, and it was just rad when we would bump into each other again. And I knew him initially through dancing, and we had stopped dancing a long time ago, and so it wasn't a very regular thing to see him. And but I get this message on MySpace a couple days before Valentine's Day of this year. And it's Jake going, Kristen, my God, you have to come. We're playing a show. Me and Amy, the Rosary Room, Valentine's Day. You got to go. We got to be there. And without even realizing that, like, Amy and Jake are performing because they hadn't done that before that I had known, I'm just like, oh, Jake wants me to go somewhere on Valentine's Day. I'm so down. I'm so there. And my boyfriend and I went to dinner, and we had to go to the Rosary Room. That's what we were going to do on Valentine's Day. And I walked up, and I saw you and Rick for the first time in quite a long time. Mm-hmm. And we sit down, and we don't really, I mean, literally at this point, I don't even know if Amy's actually playing something, because he says Amy's and him are performing, and I didn't know Amy played an instrument, so it doesn't matter. Like, I know that it's a Faust event and that it's going to be fantastic, and so we were just excited to be there and to see what was going to go on. And after the first band played, they were setting up, and Jake's 1903 pump organ, not a small instrument by any means, he literally just had it up on stage as though he were my boyfriend bringing his banjo up on stage. I mean, literally, I'm just going to put this giant instrument on stage now. And they got all set up. There was a screen to do shadow puppet shows and a drum kit and a lot of people, a lot of things going on. I don't remember exact details, but Jake starts playing. And, I mean, the music that poured out of Jake was phenomenal and was such the most amazing combination of the most interesting and, like, unique facets of music plus just this amazing other internal Jake-ness that poured out. And it was just, I mean, I don't know that anyone who's a fan of any type of music couldn't have enjoyed it. I mean, it really does take... I mean, there's something to be said for you, Faust, is you appreciate past art, and he really borrowed, I think, from that in a lot of ways, and everything from a Edith Piaf to turn-of-the-century funeral parlor music to Tom Waits.
Django Reinhardt.
I mean, it was such a gamut, and it was all the most badass stuff, you know, from start to finish. And so he just starts, and I mean, the sound that comes out of that organ is phenomenal. And Amy Faust sitting up there playing the auto harp, and then later the saw, which was excellent, and a very emotionless drummer with sunglasses, a suit, and a fez hat playing a simple drum kit. And it was fantastic. It was great, and it was exactly as I would expect a Faust event to go, without even having any expectations to begin with, only knowing it would be great. And it was just fantastic, and Jake was lovely and wonderful and expressive in every way and entertaining, and it was one of the greatest shows ever. It was just great and entertaining from start to finish.
Okay, that was... Lynn Faust and Krista talking about Jake Faust, who was shot by the San Diego police and killed on April 4th in what they said was a routine traffic stop. So I wonder if you, Janice, and Mary Lou could talk a little bit about how this has happened a lot in the past in San Diego, and I wonder if you could talk about how it affects the families and affects the communities.
Do you want to?
Go ahead.
Okay. We were deciding who was going to... I'll start. I think that interview is actually something that... every person in San Diego needs to hear about every individual that's ever been killed by the San Diego Police Department or the Sheriff's Department or the Border Patrol or the Coronado Police, or the La Mesa Police, etc. And we've got them all here in this county. Because what it does, it actually brings life to that human being. Because what happens quite frequently through the San Diego Police Department press releases is they somehow minimize that individual to a thing or a statistic. In the case of Jacob Faust, and the stories have changed, but I remember the first news release that I heard from the San Diego Police Department was, he was belligerent. He turned up his music. He was not cooperating with the officers. He turned around either to turn... See, this was the thing. He turned around to turn up his boombox, which there wasn't one in the car, mm-hmm. And was ignoring the officers, and then reached for something. So somehow they made him into this grotesque, defiant, larger-than-life human being. And that's what they did with the case of actually Sansaray Holloway, a 21-year-old woman who was 5 months pregnant. She's a big girl, 5'4", almost 200 pounds. Mm. And she was handcuffed and placed in the back of a police car. Now, this big girl kicked out the back window of the Border Patrol car, got out of her handcuffs, and charged the Border Patrol agent. Now, you know, I watched a lot of Superman when I was growing up, but that story comes from some cartoon line, and the police department did a really good job of also minimizing her as a human being. They did it with Billy Venable. Billy Venable was somebody who was on parole, so somehow he's less than human. Mm-hmm. And you see that a lot, especially with parolees. When you are on parole, you have a fourth waiver, which means an officer can pull you over at any time. He can stop you on the street at any time. They can go into your house at any time. No reason why. That unfortunately is an aspect of being on parole. And in the case of Billy, well, he had been to prison, he was on parole, so somehow it was okay to shoot and kill him right in the back of the head. And this is something that we see as a pattern of the San Diego Police Department over and over and over again. And in the recent book, Breaking Rank, written by Norm Stamper, who was on the police force in San Diego up until 93, 94, he exposes everything that we're stating here tonight. He talks about his killing an unarmed individual in the University Heights area in the 70s and the 80s. And unfortunately, this is a pattern of abuse that's been going on. Actually, I should say a pattern of crime, police crime, that's been going on for decades. And people just need to persevere and continue to work to dismantle it. You've got to file the complaints. You've got to file the claims. You've got to keep finding a lawyer who will take your case. And what's very interesting is many of the top lawyers in San Diego, such as Mike Marinin, Peter Friesen, are overwhelmed with police brutality cases. And in many situations, families have to go outside the county to get a lawyer. They're just swamped. Between Border Patrol, military, San Diego Police Department, Sheriff's Department, Coronado Police, El Cajon Police, La Mesa Police, it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming for the few good lawyers that are here that actually are not afraid to take on law enforcement agencies.
So, I'm just having a momentary brain malfunction.
That's all right.
but it happens pretty often.
Yes, that's all right.
But let me just remind our listeners that you're listening to Communities of San Diego, and you can actually participate with us. We invite you to participate, to give us a call at 619-269-4693. Or you can instant message us at AOL or Yahoo Messenger. The instant message ID is Radioactive SD. So maybe to talk a little bit more about how people deal with these situations and can resist, basically. The brutality to find a way to, once it's happened, to deal with it. One of the things that both Lynn and Krista were talking a lot about when I was talking to them the other day is basically kind of an emotional, the kind of emotional almost breakdown that you have in these situations, and you feel that you have no support. No emotional support, no kind of way of figuring out like what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to feel. The media, the day it happened, the media, they came into their loft, you know, with cameras, and you know, they didn't want to like say no because, you know, they wanted to talk about their son, but also it's just incredibly difficult to deal with that. And so I'm wondering, like, what ways can people deal with these kind of situations?
Well, this is something that I don't think any of us really prepare for. There's not a handbook to tell us how to. And in the case of the Faust family, one of the things we discussed is who would be the family spokesperson. And right now, I believe that's still Amy. Parents should never have to bury their children. And what is very interesting in the case of families who have lost loved ones to police murder, they are not eligible for the victim's crime benefits. Like, say, if I was sexually assaulted, I would automatically get benefits through the state for counseling for as long as I wanted. But because this is a state employee, city employee, but you know what I mean, it's like state-sanctioned employee, they're not eligible for that. And to talk about the healing that these families need to go through, what I have found is that the only other people they can talk to are other family members that have lost one to police crime. And in the case of Lynn, we really are trying to get Lynn, Cherry, and Sister Iman together. What was so amazing about Cherry, as soon as she lost her daughter, she was out within a week screaming out in the streets, ready to take the police on. She had no fear. She did not care. Wow. Federico Adame III, his mom was out 2 days out in the streets screaming at the cops. And then to see the two women come together, because there was only 3 months apart of when they lost their children, but to see the two women come together, you know, there was nothing that you or I or Mary Lou could have done or said that these two women gave to each other that needed to be, even I think it was just a hug when that was downtown. It was just the hug, and to see those two women hug for like 3 to 4 minutes, that was the beginning of the healing for them. But one of the, there is a sense, you know, you go through the grief. Stuff like this is sudden, and there's all these stages of grief we talk about. But then, you know, for example, when Lynn wanted to know how to get a complaint, and this is when you talk about the complaints, how important they are. I think she called the district attorney's office, and the district attorney's office, the woman on the other end of the line stated, well, didn't you think they were right? Did you think they did something wrong? And then they said, well, you need to, I forgot who they sent her to get a complaint. Now, it's also very difficult to get a complaint form unless you go to the website. I don't, do you want to talk about how difficult it is?
Well, you go to, first of all, the police department, when they went to all these community meetings, they handed out this list, and they claimed that you could get these police complaint forms at all these different community centers. You go to the community centers, and what they say is, we never, you know, even heard about. So we have no, you know, no knowledge. You go to the police department and say, oh, we don't have police complaint forms. It's the policy of any of the police departments to make it almost impossible to get a hold of a police complaint form. And while the perception is true that ultimately you're not going to get justice from that complaint form, the furthest it'll go is to the San Diego Police Review in the city, which is nothing. It's incredible. It's a group of people who are appointed by the city manager and have to have the approval of the chief of police. The police have internal affairs.
This is the Citizens Review Board.
Yeah, Citizens Review Board.
The Internal Affairs Review Board.
Yeah. Yeah, they have internal affairs officers sitting in on all of the meetings and of the Citizens Review Board. And the police provide the people on the Citizens Review Board with dinner every meeting they have. We've been to a couple of their meetings. And they won't take like verbal testimony. We've gone to several, And they say, well, you can speak, but we can't really do anything about the cases you're talking about just because you're here to testify. And we had relatives. I mean, we had the people's relatives who were on the scene and witnesses mm-hmm. of what had happened.
And they won't listen.
And
so is there a way for those people to, how can they get information? I mean, I realize that the Citizens Board is just like complete bogus, but...
Well, the only way I know at this point is to contact Copwatch, because we happen to have gotten a hold of the police complaint form, and we have several copies of them, numerous
hundreds of copies
of it, and we're more than willing to share them with anybody in the community who wants to fill one out. So that's the only way I know for sure to get a hold of one, because like I say, you go to the police station and say, oh, we don't have such a form.
Okay.
They will.
The one other agency that does have it is the Citizens Review Board office, if they have some in stock that day. 1200 3rd Avenue is the address. It's right in the community concourse, and it's room 916. Okay. And you can't go there between 12 and 1 because they are closed. They are closed quite frequently for vacation. And I remember in the case of the Billy Venable situation, it took us 2 weeks to get a complaint form, and I'm very savvy at getting complaint forms. Now, if you're lucky enough to get on the San Diego City Government's website and you're able to find it, you can download a copy, but I've only known two people that have been able to actually find it and download it because it's so difficult. Now, Copwatch does offer teach-ins 2 to 3 times a year about what your rights are on the street and how to file a complaint.
Okay. Cool. And later in the show, we'll maybe give some information about how people can contact you, if that's good.
One other thing I would like to add into what she said, when the police and the media, they not only minimize these people as human beings, they demonize them. They come up with autopsy reports that say they've got trace elements of such and such a drug. What people don't realize is that trace element means some minuscule amount, which might come from anything. Like, people should know that if you eat poppy seeds, a poppy seed bun, you're going to come up with elements of cocaine.
Morphine, actually.
Or morphine. Morphine. Mm-hmm. You know, so, but they try to make these people, they're all drug dealers, they are drug abusers, and they're, you know, and they're real policy is to isolate you, to intimidate you, and like she said, to try and keep this from getting on a written record.
Right.
Because whether anything happens at the moment with that written record, that's the basis that eventually come out to these civil cases that can... I mean, no amount of money is going to take away the pain of what they have done to you. But since you know that these people are not going to be charged criminally for what they've done, it's the only avenue we have at the moment, other than protesting in the streets, going to whatever media you can get the word out, so that it isn't covered up, and people, you know, don't remain ignorant of what. Unfortunately, San Diego has one of the worst records in the country, and a lot of people don't realize that. But San Diego County has one of the worst.
So, what do you have any statistics on that?
Actually, there's a couple of things that I brought here for you.
Cool.
And let me pull those out real quick. I actually wanted to go over pepper spray deaths. This is about 10 years old. However, I thought it was a good indicator. This research was actually done by the ACLU. Now, this is in California. In California, between January 1994 and June 1995, there were 26 in-custody deaths due to the exposure of pepper spray. All 26 victims were male. 54% were white, 19% were African-American, and 27% were Latino. In half of the 26 individuals, police restraint techniques also contributed to the death. Now, there's racial profiling. While Bejarano was the police chief, and in response to the Demetrius DeBose shooting, he asked his officers voluntarily to fill out cards each time and every time they pulled over an individual in their car. Now, they wouldn't ask them necessarily the race, so they might take a Native American sister for a Latina, correct? But now, this was all done voluntarily, and they did this for about a year, I believe, and this was in 2001. And it turned out that his own voluntary request showed conclusively that there was racial profiling going on, that over half of the individuals that were pulled over for just routine traffic stops were African American or Latino. Now, mind you, the African American population in San Diego is 6% of the general population. And this, and we were like, here it is, right, at your own hands, and you're showing that this is going on. Now, something that we do, that Cop Watch does try to do, is with these teach-ins on what your rights are, is that very respectfully, I mean, you don't want to put yourself in any type of life danger or situation, but very respectfully, you know, you're allowed to ask the officer his name, his badge number, and you can ask for a supervisor to come on the site if you feel that you've been unjustly treated. Now, in the year 2000, also as a result of Demetrius DuBose, because that was a national case because of who he was, turned out that San Diego was fourth in the country for the shootings of unarmed individuals by San Diego Police Department officers. We passed up the towns of Chicago and New York City. And you know New York City. So we have a horrible, horrible reputation. Even when Cop Watch went up to support Donovan Jackson, the young 16-year-old African-American male who was, remember, thrown on the car. When we went up there, some of the presenters from the L.A. area were talking about the struggle and about, you know, the whole, the LAPD up there and their whole, you know, the rumors and stuff that they do up there. And he said, but if you want some problems, you need to go to San Diego, because that's where the real struggle is. So we have a reputation. I mean, you go back and you look at history since the early 1900s, we are a cowboy town, and we haven't come out of that mentality. Predominantly Republican. You look at stuff like the Minutemen. They're almost being welcomed with open arms into San Diego. And there's every single type of law enforcement you could ever think of in this world that somehow is based in San Diego for some strange reason. And it just, it goes unchecked, Brad. It just goes unchecked. So I'm not trying to bring people down. What I'm trying to do is motivate people. And we are making grounds. And even in the case of William Miller, they gave a small amount of money, the homeless man who carried the stick and who was shot by the San Diego police over on Sports Arena Boulevard. Understand that the criminal case is going to be found in favor of the police department. No criminal proceedings will happen. It's the claims, like Mary Lou stated earlier. It's the money. You got to hit him where it hurts. And money talks. And there was a small amount of money that was given to the Miller family. But they wanted to give that to him so they'd go away.
So now I'd like to kind of go back to talking a little bit about Jake Faust. Thanks for all those observations and statistics. Let me just give it like a really brief summary of kind of the situation, and then we'll hear from Lynn and Krista, who were talking the other night about their experiences dealing with the police. And so basically, according to the police, this was a routine traffic stop, illegal left turn. He was stopped, Jake was stopped in his van, and exactly, you know, as Janice alluded to earlier, exactly what happened. The stories seem to be shifting. They're kind of different things are appearing in the media, and it's a little bit hard to get a handle on exactly what the police position is, but their basic position seems to be that they stopped him. They found out that his license had been suspended, and it turns out there was a DUI a few months earlier. But that was being, Jake was contesting it, and there's a whole bunch of media stuff about that, and we'll hear a little bit about that. But they said basically that they would have to impound his vehicle, and then they said he became belligerent. He turned up his boombox or radio, and refused to get out and of the vehicle. And then he, and then there's differing accounts as to whether they initially, and there were now at this point two officers on the scene, and there's differing accounts about whether they pepper sprayed him or not. Mm-hmm. There's no independent evidence of that in the autopsy, or I think in the vehicle as well. And then they said, and then again, this is a little bit fuzzy, but one of the officers apparently saw a gun in the back pocket of the vehicle, although also of the passenger seat, I'm sorry. But they also said it was too dark to see in the vehicle, so it's a little bit hard to know what that means. Then they said they thought he was reaching, they either thought he was reaching for the gun or had the gun in his hand and was bringing it up. And at that point, they stepped back and shot him three times. And there's a whole bunch of inconsistencies, a whole bunch of questions about this scenario. It doesn't really make sense. And I'll play this little clip from Lynn and Krista that'll talk about a little bit about some of their questions and some of their experiences in dealing with the cops. And needless to say, those weren't positive. So here's again Lynn and Krista talking about Jake Faust.
The police came to our door a little after 8 that morning, and they came in what I would call an interrogation mode. They came in asking questions. They wanted to know if Jake lived there, where else he lived, who he hung around with, you know, who his friends were. And they kind of continued on in that mode for a while. And we asked them, you know, why was Jake in some kind of trouble? And they said, yes, very serious trouble. And so they started telling us this story that he had been pulled over for making an illegal turn. And that he had been driving on a suspended license, which we did not know. Apparently it was suspended in February, on February 13th. For what they are saying was a DUI. And what we told them at that point, knew that he had filed a complaint against the police department. We had had people who identified themselves as internal affairs calling there and asking for Jake at our home over the previous couple of weeks. Somebody who identified herself as Kelly Johnson, I believe. Whose name appears in the records from that time, so I'm not exactly sure what her involvement was, but anyway, that's who had been calling and leaving messages for him. So they continued saying that the police officers wanted him to get out of the vehicle and that he didn't cooperate with them, and that it was too dark for them to see into the van, and he made what they interpreted as a threatening movement. And at that point, I stopped them and asked them if he had been shot. And they told us, yes, that he had been and that he did not survive. Then they told us that they had recovered a toy gun from the vehicle and that it had been painted black. That the orange band on it had been painted black, and they repeated that several times. When the detective told me that Jake had been shot and that it was too dark for them to see into the van, he said he called it an unfortunate series of events that happened too quickly. He repeated that a couple of times. Instead of coming in to tell us something, that they had very bad news, they came in asking questions. You know, like they had him in custody somewhere, or like, you know, he had been in an accident or something. You know, like he was still alive, you know, where were his friends? Well, who does he hang out with? Like, what happened, you know? The police did not mention pepper spray to us that morning, to my recollection, and I did write everything down as soon as, you know, I could. Mm-hmm. Neither Rick or myself remember them ever using the words pepper spray. But it was reported widely in the media that he was pepper sprayed, and that after that point, after they said that after struggling with him and pepper spraying him, that then at that point he turned and reached for what they thought was a gun, which absolutely makes no sense because his eyes would have been his main. Jake was very sensitive to pain and was not a fighter, was not used to being in altercations with anyone. To my knowledge, he never had been. And pretty much to the knowledge of everyone that knew him, you know, he was never a fighter, ever. So that's just completely, first of all, it's just a ludicrous thought that someone would reach for a toy. You know, either they're a complete idiot or they're suicidal, neither which was he. So that doesn't even stand up, let alone what would you be doing if you had just been sprayed, you know, if they had used pepper spray on him. I know where his hands were. They were in his face. If they used pepper spray on him.
But I wonder if you could talk about where, you know, where this gun might have come from, or do you think it was even in the vehicle?
I don't. In addition to the fact that I don't think it was, that he was not known to have a toy gun like that. Mm-hmm. There is no blood in the van, except for on the door ledge leading out of the van. There's a little bit there, but that's all. There are no bullet holes in the seats or in any of the other windows. But what was in the van and was very interesting, in this back pocket where they're talking that they saw this toy gun sticking out of supposedly, what was sticking out of the back pocket when the van was released to us was still in its package, a Pez candy dispenser. You know, the little dispensers that have the little characters on the top of them, and it's a policewoman's head. And that is sticking out of the top of the back pocket, which is elasticized, and it would make sense to think that if anybody had displaced anything next to it, that it would have fallen to the bottom of that pocket. However, it was sticking out of the top of the pocket when we got the van back. Part of, you know, the three main issues that we have, aside from the huge obvious fact that they took his life unnecessarily and used undue force, the clothing that was withheld from the coroner's office, that's inexcusable. The photograph that they say that they showed Rick, which they're saying now is from the hospital, which we know wasn't, that's inexcusable. The trajectory of the bullets are inconsistent with their story. The timeline is inconsistent with any kind of a decent response time in the downtown area to anything. And that, coupled with the fact that it took them over 6 hours to come around the block and notify us, Jake's van was registered to our address. You know, I understand they had a scene to investigate, but we were right around the corner. You know, to me, that's inexcusable. That, and then the very obvious that his van was there every night, that he walked those streets every night, that they knew this was not a criminal. He had never been involved in any altercation of any kind. He was basically harmless, and they killed him. And there's nothing they can say or do to justify that. Nothing. And the media didn't address any of that.
Right.
We talked to them about it, just like I am to you right now.
Mm-hmm.
But none of the news channels put any of that out there for people to think about. They target the poor. They target the homeless downtown, definitely. Jake knew that.
Mm-hmm.
He told us about it all the time. You know, he saw a lot of what they do and the harassment that they carry out, you know, on people. Just because, I don't know, maybe they're having just a night with nothing better to do. And you know what it reminds you of? A high school bully. Or a grade school bully. The kid that was always mean and picking on somebody. You know, there are a lot of people out there carrying weapons with that attitude, and it's very scary. I have a relative that is married to an L.A. County sheriff, and the day Jake was killed, they called immediately and said the first thing we needed to do was get an independent autopsy and to check the trajectory and not to believe anything the police said. He's been an L.A. County sheriff for, you know, over 20 years, and I don't believe has ever had to shoot anyone. But those were his words of advice to us.
Right.
We did have a local attorney, a very reputable attorney, who did come to the loft. at the call of a mutual friend and actually spent some time with us. And the first thing he did when he came in and sat down and talked to us was tell us that the city is extremely corrupt from the judges on down, that the police in San Diego change evidence, they make up evidence, they lose evidence, they do pretty much anything that they need to do to make things go their way, and that it would not be an easy time for it, you know, for us with this here. And he was dead serious when he said this, you know. It was like, this is a bad place and there's bad stuff going on, and this is going to be really difficult for you to prove this case or to win it, you know, against these officers.
So it says, this is from the Union Tribune on December 12th. Nearly all patrol officers now carry non-lethal beanbag shotguns in the trunks of their patrol cars. New department policy also calls for supervising sergeants to be dispatched to the scene immediately in circumstances where patrol officers may face a choice of using deadly or non-lethal force. The result, says Lansdowne, is a sharp decline in officer-involved shootings. So, Lynn, you then wrote an email to Lansdowne.
And when I addressed it, I said, Mr. Lansdowne, these are your reported facts of policy and procedure, sir, to produce a sharp decline in officer-involved shootings in San Diego. At least that is what you tell the public. And then I quoted the article to him. At the end of that, I stated, less than 4 months after you spoke these words to the media, officers under your command took the life of my son with lethal force in the most unlawful way. Your own words contradict your actions, and you will be held accountable. You are a liar, and you will be revealed as one.
What exactly do you do when this people who are supposed, that are paid by tax dollars to protect and to serve and to defend and to do all these things, are the people who did the outrageous and disgusting and illegal action of killing an innocent person? Where do you turn to? Who polices the police? And I mean, especially with the bogus citizen review board, the whole
bit. Yeah, the answer to that in San Diego is no one. There is no one that holds the police accountable here in town. And until the citizens stand up and do something, I don't know that there will be anyone, unless maybe it's done on a national, you know, maybe a federal level, that someone forces them. Maybe the state attorney general's office needs to get involved and say, you know, why is the Wild West going on in San Diego?
Okay. So that was Lynn Faust and Krista, Jake's friend, talking about Jake Faust and their experiences in dealing with the cops. And this is Communities of San Diego on Radioactive Radio, and we're discussing Cop Watch, Jake Faust, and the San Diego Police Department. And here in the studio, we have Janice and Mary Lou. And thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you, Brad.
From CopWatch. And Janice, you guys have a conference coming up. Why don't you talk a little bit?
Yes, we're extremely excited, I don't think is a good word, but we are energized that we're actually able to get this together. This conference, it's the Saigon Penn Chapter of CopWatch San Diego, will hold a conference on August 27th, 2005, at the Hot Monkey Love Cafe, which has also been a target of, I don't know, police observation, shall I say. We want, under the Patriot Act, we're still investigating that. And the conference is scheduled from 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. It's more of a panel discussion. There'll be four separate panels, and including profiling, harassment, abuse of police power, justifiable homicide in the case of the murder by law enforcement officials. And we will have some just amazing activists, people that have lost loved ones, people that have been active for years, young people. And if people are interested in setting up their community tables, you must be a grassroots organization. Please contact me at 619 619- 475-8227. It is a sliding scale donation at the door. It is all ages, but no one is turned away for lack of funds. And once again, that's August 27th, 2005 at the Hot Monkey Love Cafe on El Cajon Boulevard near College Avenue.
And do people need to make reservations, or can they
just
show up?
Nope, they can show up at the door. We thought about doing a registration, but you know what? That's too much paperwork. Just show up at the door.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I just want to mention that one of our listeners just wrote in and wanted to thank Lynn and Crystal also for speaking out.
Amazing women.
Yeah.
Amazing women.
So one of the things I'd like to turn to, kind of, we have way too much to talk about for this show, but
right.
And maybe you two can come back sometime.
Of course.
I hope. And we can talk more about...
maybe right before the conference.
Yeah.
And there'll be a lot more information we'll probably be able to discuss about the Faust case. I think you and I were talking as Lynn and Krista were speaking that there's some things we just can't say because we are trying to get a lawyer. There is a lawyer interested in the case. And just once again, my heart goes out to Lynn and Rick. I don't know how they do it. I just don't know how they do it. They keep plugging away.
Yeah, it's really... I find it really, it's very sad to talk with them, but also I think very hopeful because you just kind of realize the incredible reserve of it's just kind of like courage and strength to kind of deal with this dealing with this awful situation, and also, going up against the San Diego police, which is a pretty hard thing to do.
Yes, it is.
So I want to talk a little bit maybe about the media. And one thing that struck me I pay almost no attention to the corporate media, so I was...
What a good man.
I was way... behind on this story, because that's initially the reporting was in the corporate media, but I went back and looked at it, and it's just amazing how inaccurate it was, and also just how it seemed to be their purpose in life is to repeat what the San Diego police tell them to say. And it did seem like the police basically were using the media to get out their message. And is this basically the standard procedure for how they deal with these situations?
It's been the standard procedures. Gosh, I can remember back being in high school, and when a lot of homeboys were killed as a result of the choke that the police officers used to put on them, and how they made them less than human, how the media, it was almost, they were a rubber stamp besides the internal affairs for what the police department did. And what I've noticed is that, and I can't remember his name, one of the, I believe he was a Channel 8 commentator back in the early 90s, ended up becoming the spokesperson for the San Diego Police Department. So if you want to say one hand washes the other, I'm sure they, it's like, it's kind of like the White House. This is what you're going to say, and this is how you're going to say it, and this is how it will be portrayed. So I really want to give props to Free Press, Zinger's Magazine, even the Daily California, La Prensa sometimes, comes together. Workers' World, The Partisan, many of these real community papers get the truth out. Unfortunately, like you said, we don't have a lot of money in that aspect. But people are getting it. And I think especially with Jacob's death, when I talked to people downtown when we were looking for witnesses, people knew who Jacob was. And they know that something's not right. And so you've just got your average downtown party goer that's starting to think about things. And unfortunately, I wish we didn't have to lose somebody so people would start to think for themselves.
Yeah. We're gonna play a segment about Lynn and Krista talking about their dealing with the media, which again, kind of like dealing with the cops has not been very positive. But but before I do that, I just want to ask one kind of, I guess I kind of view it as a hard question. to ask, but I sort of think it's a question that we should be asking. And that is, you know, Jacob is a white guy, mm-hmm. you know, young, good looking, mm-hmm. And you know, it's, and his family is just, I mean, they have an amazing amount of energy and determination, and you know, it's not, they're not wealthy, but they have resources, you know, that a lot of people don't have access
like
to.
Cherry Mason, like yeah. the Adames.
Right, right.
Like Sister Iman, yes.
Right. So I guess I'm wondering whether you think that because, you know, of the advantages, you know, the advantages that maybe we think people shouldn't have in society, but that's just the way it is.
Like privilege of skin color?
Right. Mm. That maybe this one can actually go further and something might actually happen.
And I understand what you're saying, and unfortunately I believe that you're right. Billy Venable was on parole. Sansaray Holloway had been released from Las Colinas not too long ago. Federico Adame was a Chicano. Emmanuel Sotelo was a Chicano. Jose Luis Ramirez was a Chicano growing up in Barrio Logan. And so it's almost you have this affiliation with either the prison industrial complex or the community that you live in that you're already guilty. And yeah, we need to use this to our advantage. And hopefully Jacob's case will expose what poor people, homeless people like William Miller and their families have suffered through decades. I don't know. And, you know, it's interesting, the case of Demetrius DeBose, it was because of who he was as an NFL football player. When you look at the district attorney's report, that report was so thick, I've got my fingers probably an inch of paperwork. Nothing had ever been done like that before. But that's because the nation was watching, because he was a National Football League player, football player. Mm-hmm. And that exposed that, yes, in fact, San Diego's rate of the shooting of unarmed individuals is fourth in the country. Now it'll be interesting to see what Jake's death exposes. I just wish we didn't have to lose him.
So let's go to Lynn and Krista then, talking about their experiences with the media. What have your interactions been with the press?
Well, with the exception of Kelly Davis from City Beat and yourself and the lovely gals that hosted the show the other week. We have
Queen
had
Bee.
Queen Bee and Pepperbox
right,
on their
yeah,
show.
Yeah. And also Jake from
Jake Sex. Yes. Other than that, I have had no contact with the media until the night of our handing out flyers on Memorial Day weekend, Sunday night. The media showed up at our door in force at 9:00. I'm not sure why. They haven't bothered to come out when we filed a complaint for any of the organized events that we've had as far as fundraisers go. They've chosen not to be present at those, but they were all there Sunday night. And I asked them why they hadn't, you know, why they waited almost 2 months to talk to us. And they didn't really have a response to that because I emailed and made phone calls and they didn't publish anything I sent them or anything my family sent them. So the only way I can explain that is that they're being complicit with the police department and only putting out the story that they want San Diego to hear.
Really starting to break on the news, and they were just starting to say his name, and all they were really saying about him was this prior stop for a DUI. And just that's all they really said about who Jake was. And I think it kind of clicked in your head. I remember you saying, I don't want anyone, you know, no one to publicly grieve. But as soon as they start not reporting correctly, talking about, that's when I think it really shifted in on this side, which was, if they're going to start talking, better know who this. And I think that's when it wasn't far from that the vigil was decided to do on that day.
One of the first things they did was ask me for another picture of him because they didn't
right,
like the one.
Right, that's what you were doing when I came in, was looking for pictures of Jake.
I was crawling around on my knees. I remember looking for something that they would find acceptable, and I couldn't get my. I was looking for a senior picture, which I don't know why, because it's old now, and he had a lot of facial hair in the last year or so, and he looked 10 years older with it. And I was literally crawling around on my knees looking for this picture. I thought I couldn't talk to them at all. Rick talked to them, and he was very upset still. He was, and at that point, when they came in, I hadn't cried yet.
Right.
I had a lot of phone calls to make, and Amy was just hysterical. She never stopped screaming for hours, and Rick was just about beside himself, and I knew once I started crying, I just didn't know if I could ever stop. So I didn't for as long as I could. And then once I did, I don't remember much after that.
I remember finally getting them to have you lay down. And in fact,
I remember going to urgent care that night.
Lynn ended up in urgent care that night. Once you did, I think, submit a little bit to what actually happened. It was physically taking you down the wrong road. And so, in fact, I learned about your trip to urgent care on the 11 o'clock news. A couple of them must have found that out literally during that session, because it was the very tail end of one of the last shows I saw, and they say, and we just learned that Jacob's mother has gone to the hospital. And that's where I learned of it. It was the press was where we learned that a prior DUI, refusal to take the test. Because in all the stories and in all the press, all they really had to go on was the official press release from the police department. And it was only upon our insistence to make sure they knew that this is not in step with who Jake was,
right,
that it really, that's the only reason I believe that they were, and that they would then kind of say, oh, well, Jake wasn't, I mean, it wasn't much, but, you know, it had moved a little bit towards that, rather than just that this is a guy who was stopped last month and that's all we're ever going to say about it.
Yeah, and I don't remember them even actually ever saying that he had filed a complaint.
I don't think that came out initially.
There was an investigation going on.
It was only because you knew that that internal affairs supposedly had been calling.
Yeah, I mean, they were calling our home, so we knew what was going on, and they were not quick to tell the rest of San Diego that, though. And or that a Pitches motion had been filed with that case, or that, you know, and then when we got the records, you know, the blood alcohol results are still not in there. They were never officially recorded from what we've seen, and everything is just really questionable about that. And that was their main basis for making Jake look like he had some kind of a past. You know, he had no criminal history.
It was just initially a bold-faced lie, since
yeah,
we have been able to find out limited information, but do have copy of a record not only stating Jacob was fully compliant, cooperative, didn't need any restraint, and
took, totally coherent, passed all of the verbal tests that they gave,
took a breathalyzer, took a blood test. I mean, he literally did all these things that initially they had said, no, he didn't. So they revoked his license, and that's a history of noncompliance, which is wholly and 100% false. As we finally were able to obtain even the most minute of information, just throwing it at all types of media,
nothing was published.
Nothing was published. Nothing was picked up on. No guarantee that they were going to follow up on anything. And the only person to respond to Lynn in her outreaching of trying to get people involved was Kelly Davis from CityBeat. She wanted to do a profile on Jake. She wanted to let people know who this guy was, because prior to that, no one had even asked the family, we understand your son was killed. Can you tell us who your son was? I don't think that question was ever asked.
His funeral was attended by hundreds of people. Hundreds. But there was no media there. not one news station, not one reporter, no one. And I thought that really struck me as odd because we weren't sure what to expect that day. But the absolute total silence on the part of the media as far as covering who he was as a person, how many people knew him, you know, that so many in the community came out to say goodbye to him and to honor him, and yet none of that was recorded or published or broadcast to anyone. And it was like they just wanted the whole thing to go away.
I mean, despite our attempts to get as much media involved, based on the limited times, really the first day and Memorial Day weekend with the flyering of downtown being really the only two main times they were present and did decide to show up for whatever reason, really only paints the picture that they're interested in a slant and salaciousness.
Oh, definitely.
Despite all the information that they will get when they do talk to us. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lynn can point out every inconsistency from start to finish, and the only thing they put on the news that night was a sentence from Lynn and a sentence from Rick. They weren't bad ones. I mean, they were just...
No, but they weren't the main point.
But they
either,
weren't,
you know,
the main point. He was talking about Clear Channel 4 years ago and how ridiculous it is that we're supposed to sit on our couches and hear the local news and just be okay with weird reports of, you know, it should be significant. People should hear even the bogus headlines that have gone, man with fake gun shot dead. People shouldn't be okay with accepting that and want to know, why would somebody pull a fake gun? Mm-hmm. Is that something that actually happened, or is this just the most silly thing I've ever heard? And so it's been an interesting lesson in the media.
Okay, so that was Lynn Faust and Krista talking about their interactions with the media following Jake's death on April 4th. Janice and Mary Lou, do you have any final comments then about the Jake Faust case?
What I want to make clear to people is that Cop Watch shows the utmost respect and patience with families, and we will wait until somebody contacts us. For example, the brother who was killed out in Lakeside. We let friends know of the man who was shot in Lakeside by the sheriffs. You know, we are here. If you need us, please let us know. Not only do we help people file out complaints and claims, but we will also go to court with you, help collect witness testimonies, etc. We will go through the whole process with you. We just don't, you know, show up for the media and leave. So we always defer everything to the family, as in the case with the Faust. We waited for them to contact us because ultimately it comes down to what the family wants and the family needs. We do meet the fourth Sunday of every month at the Hot Monkey Love Cafe on El Cajon Boulevard near College Avenue at 6:30, and on